Hello and welcome back to Let the Stone Speak. I'm Brent Nuchtigal, your host. Today we're going to discuss a subject I've wanted to get into for a long time. This is the discovery of rock-cut rooms just above the Gihon Spring in Jerusalem, what some people are calling Temple Zero. If you've been there, you know it's a highly interesting area. There are a lot of questions to be asked. The limits of archaeology are certainly felt in this area, considering the complex is excavated into or carved out of bedrock, destroying or not really leaving any flaws to give us an earliest date of the site. However, its proximity to the Gihon Spring and also the biblical tradition or biblical writings of things that took place in this area make us want to relate it to biblical stories. So we're going to be discussing that today based on two scientific papers. One came out just very recently, the other one came out a year ago, and then we'll go through some of what I think about what we have here just above the Gihon Spring, the water source in ancient Jerusalem. Don't forget to like and subscribe to our channel if you enjoy the content, and also you can sign up for our Biblical Archaeology magazine. It's absolutely free. It's called Let the Stone Speak as well. This is our latest issue. It covers the Exodus, another 10th century site in the northern Israel. Has another few articles. It's about 40 pages in there. And it covers biblical archaeology or biblical history. And as I said, comes out 6 times per year. It's free. Go to armstronginstitute.org. You'll see a place to sign up on the front page. Or write an email to letters@armstronginstitute.org and place your name and address, and we'll sign you up for your subscription. We only ask that you renew every year to ensure that we don't keep sending them to people that don't value it. But I'm sure that won't be you. If you do sign up, we also, as an introduction, we also send out our exhibit edition. We had an exhibit here in Edmond, Oklahoma, and it was covering the Kingdom of David and Solomon. We had about 40 plus artifacts from the 10th century from Israel, including the famous Tel Dan Stele, artifacts from Kirbet Kayafa, new discoveries, golden discoveries from the Ophel there in Jerusalem, just south of the Temple Mount wall. And this was the magazine we handed out. It's about 130 pages and it's beautifully illustrated, goes into all the current archaeological evidence that corroborates or supports where it can the biblical narrative related to King David and King Solomon. Okay, let's get into this. By way of introduction, what I'm going to do is quote for you an article that was just published this week by Christopher Eames, my colleague at the Armstrong Institute. He lives in Jerusalem, has lived there for the past almost 5 years. He worked with Dr. Eilat Mazar. He works now with Professor Uzi Liebner and Yosef Garfinkel in Jerusalem as well as an area supervisor on those excavations. And so he's had a history going back to 2012 in excavating Jerusalem and then gradually becoming, well, the next year actually, becoming part of the staff. He assisted me in Area B on the Ophel that year. So his article, it's called Worship or Workshop, Making Sense of the City of David Rock Cut Rooms. And it's going to go through a general introduction to the site, going to go through what they've discovered, and then compare two different academic papers. One that was put out by the lead excavator of the site, Eli Shukron, and others, and we'll quote from that. And then a recent publication by the excavator over at Tel Asafi Gath, Aaron Mayer, has written a bit of a rebuttal, I suppose, as to the cultic function or the religious function of these rooms. Now, this is important because Jerusalem's obviously the center for religious worship in ancient Israel. Once a temple is built by King Solomon, but this area is largely, what's not really focused on is that that Jerusalem was also one of the religious centers, if not the religious center from David's time, about 40 years earlier than when the temple was finished in its construction. And the Ark of the Covenant was in Jerusalem for 30 to 40 years, separated from the tabernacle, which was at Gibeon at the time. And if you're going to go by the biblical text, It should be. That ark was somewhere placed in the city of David during the time of David, by David, before it went to the temple. Could this be the location of where the ark was? We will take you through what they found archaeologically. You can search and to search Temple Zero on YouTube or read blogs, and you'll get a lot of tours to the site and what people think about the site. We are going to go through what the archaeologists say, see how it compares to the dating of these different biblical events, so you can see where archaeology ends and where inference begins and where the Bible perhaps can fill in some of the gaps as well. So this article, I'll leave it in the show notes, by Christopher Eames, just quoting the first paragraph here. It says, since their unearthing in 2010-2011 excavations of Eli Shukran and Roni Reich, the City of David rock cut rooms have generated significant interest and speculation. The unusual nature of the rooms, including apparently cultic installations, and when it says cultic, it just means religious. The word cultic for Western ears has a negative connotation to it. That's not the connotation that it has when we're talking about archaeology. It just means religious. And Middle Bronze Age pottery has led to a popular conclusion that the complex is none other than the Temple of Melchizedek, the mysterious, or Melchizedek, the mysterious king priest of Salem or Shalem, on the scene at the time of Abraham from Genesis 14. It's popularly become known as Temple Zero, and so on. Going down, it says, finally, last year, Eli Shukran, Leora Freud, Helena Roth, Reli Avassar, and Efrat Bocher published a very detailed scientific report on the structure in the Antiquities, Israel Antiquities Authority journal, Atikot. Their paper, titled Evidence of Worship in the Rock Cup Rooms on the Eastern Slope of the City of David, Jerusalem. So that was when it was published, and I have that right here in front of me. We're going to go through parts of that, that detail some of the functions of these rooms, the details of the dating of the site. I think I told you last time we were talking that archaeology is all about dating, because without the dating of the site, how are you going to fit it into a right historical context? How are you going to even match it with the biblical text as well, unless you have accurate dating for the site? And most of the time, no site is dated exactly or with an absolute date. Sometimes you get a date window of when it was in use, and so we are led to add some speculation as we go. Okay, then he goes through a simple overview of what they found there. He writes this, in simple overview, the rock cut rooms are a series of bedrock cut chambers located partway down the eastern slope of the City of David, adjacent south of the Gihon Spring. So just above the spring, up the ridge a little bit to the City of David, which was the ancient Jebusite city, Fortress of Zion, as it's called in the Bible, just above the Gihon Spring there. And the Gihon Spring, it's so important. It's the reason Jerusalem is where it is, because you need a water source for your ancient settlements, and so to withstand siege and other things. And the Gihon Spring is perennial, goes year-round. It's mentioned in the text a lot of times in the Bible. There's a lot of metaphor that's attached to the spring, the wells of salvation, Isaiah calls it. The fountain of living waters is what Jeremiah calls it in Jeremiah chapter 2. There's a lot of the waters that go softly, the Shiloach, another name of the spring, in Isaiah chapter 8, I believe it is. And so the spring is very important. It's a life source for the city. And so it makes sense then, when we're talking about a religious site, that it would be located somewhere by the spring. He continues, they consist, these rock cut chambers, of a number of unusual features carved into the bedrock, including one room containing three strange, deeply cut V-shaped incisions. And they are strange at the time. They didn't know what these were when they found this, and they put this on Facebook, a picture of it, and opened it up to the masses. What do you think about these things? What are they? We'll talk about that. Another with some kind of channel leading from a small bedrock platform. And another with a small olive press apparatus. Most notably, one of the central rooms contained a small rock-built platform supporting a thin standing stone about 20 centimeters high and 1 meter wide, interpreted as a matzeva, a ritual standing stone. These features have been cancelled out, covered with earth sometime during the 8th century BCE. 8th century BCE, end of the 8th century, mid to end, Hezekiah, middle of it, 8th century, Uzziah. So this is when these rooms were cancelled out, meaning that the entire area was covered. These rooms were covered with pottery that dates to the middle of the 8th century. And then a big macking wall was built over the top of all of it, definitely telling us that it was cancelled out. But the time period in which it was built or carved into bedrock is far harder to determine. Here we go. It says, in this context, the raised rectangular platform with a drainage channel in room 1 has been interpreted as perhaps the foundation and drain for an altar, the olive press in room 2 as being used for ritual purposes, the production of anointing oil, room 4 with its standing stone, perhaps representing a sort of holy of holies, room 5 containing a favisa, which is a location for ritually discarded cultic materials within its separate western chamber. That's in room 5. And finally, the V-shaped cutouts in the open part of room 5, having perhaps serving as a support for a tripod or contraption of some kind to slaughter animals. So this is kind of the popular interpretation of what we have here. I do want to just go now to this paper that was written by Aaron Mayer. He published this in Cultic Kisses, Festschrift for Angelika Berlingjung. Sorry if I have mispronounced that. This was published in early 2026. And he says, reviewing the date and function of the rock-cut tombs in the City of David. So he's going to describe the tombs, and then he gets to the dating. And we're just going to look at this for a second, because it's all about dating, right? If you're going to say that this was Melchizedek's, then you should have dating to support when Melchizedek lived. And if we're talking about Abraham, some depending on how you date Abraham, I would say sometime 19th, or sometimes people put it a little bit earlier, but 19th, 18th centuries, somewhere in there. Let's put it that way. Shukran et al. Suggested that the dating of these features was as follows. They were used in the Middle Bronze Age, circa 1700 BCE, and continued to be used until the 8th century BCE. Now, this is interesting because from all I could read, when it says they were first used in the Middle Bronze Age, 17th century BCE, there is no date, specific date, that is going to be attached to Shukran in Shukran's paper to when he believes this was in use. And in fact, he doesn't give the 1700 BCE date for it. He actually gives, based on the dating of a room that's very adjacent, I think it's called room 8. It's not one of the rock cut rooms, but it is adjacent to the whole structure. And in that room, they do have a floor, and he's got Middle Bronze Age pottery in there. But he dates the room itself to the Middle Bronze Age, Late Bronze Age horizon, this shift from the Middle Bronze Age to the Late Bronze Age, which would probably be dated more in the 16th century, sometime in the 1500s. And yet you see here that already there's a discrepancy between Mayer's interpretation of Eli Shukran's work and what Eli Shukran et al. Wrote in their paper, as we'll get to. He says, the settlement in this area probably began in the transition from the Middle Bronze, or the Middle to the Late Bronze, and this complex went out of use in the mid-8th century BCE in an organized and orderly manner while preserving and protecting the important ritual items in the complex. He's dating it from the transition, surely, at the end of the Middle Bronze Age to the Late Bronze Age. And then, as he writes in there, it supports, his dating of this room is supported by carbon dates that were done by Regev. And if you look at those carbon dates, that's Joanna Regev, a good friend. If you look at those carbon dates, and she's from the Weizmann Institute there in Rehovot. The carbon dates they received mostly, I believe, are in the 1500s. I'll put that on screen for you as well. So we're kind of looking 16th century from when it looks like, from at least room 8 of when the place was in use. It could have been before these other rooms. The problem is, as even Shukran brings out, is that the rock cut rooms were into bedrock, right? And so typically to get a dating of a room, you need to have the stuff that came from underneath the floor. The material that came underneath the floor, you get a date for that, and you get a date for the material above the floor. And it gives you a window of time in which that floor was being used. Unfortunately, the floor is bedrock. You can't go through bedrock. Or if you do, there's going to be no dateable material. It'll just be more bedrock, won't it? And so we don't have a date from which these rock cuts grooves were first made. All we have is a date from an adjacent room. Now, there is a point in the paper by Mayer that he pretty much says, since the only dating we have for it comes from room 8, which is not one of the rock cut rooms, which is by the side, just towards closer to the spring, then we can't really use that to date the rest of the rock cut rooms themselves. And that is a valid point. So he doesn't believe it's connected to the rooms, to where you've got these nice chambers with ritualistic function, evidence of it. And Shukran disagrees, and the others disagree. They believe it does have connection to this room. Now, in elements like this, where you have two competing opinions by archaeologists, I always defer, unless there's overwhelming evidence, I defer to the excavator themselves. They were there. They understood the layers that came above and below. They probably have their reasons, and they do put some of their reasons why they believe through this step going up from this room to the actual complex that they are connected. So I would tend to go along with Eli Shukran, but granted, point granted here by Aaron Mayer. Thus, based on the finds from within these rooms and the city wall that cancelled them out, it appears that these rock cut rooms were in use in the early 8th century BCE and perhaps a little bit earlier. There's no evidence for the use of these features in the other periods. And, you know, he says there's no evidence for the use of these rooms in other periods. Of course there's not. It's carved into bedrock. So, it could have been. There could have been evidence, but that evidence was removed. In a cultic area, they would probably cleanse the floor often, cleaning the bedrock. So to say that just because it's cancelled out in the 8th century, sometime in the 8th century, mid-8th century, that it was used in the 8th century and perhaps a little bit earlier, well, how far earlier? It could have been 1,000 years earlier, as far as we know. So there's a little bit of debate in between those two papers. I'm going to put links to both of these. If you're interested, I would definitely study into this, because this shows you what archaeology can determine, the difference of opinions of some scholars, the fairness of those opinions. And then you can base, if you like, a biblical reconstruction on that. So from what I would say right now is to say that this belonged to Melchizedek. I would say the archaeological dating actually puts it after Melchizedek's time from its earliest use. Is it cancelled out in the 8th century BCE? Absolutely. We can bicker on whether it's mid to late to early 8th century BCE. It looks like it's mid-8th century BCE. It would have been nice to put it Hezekiah's time, who was a little bit later. It looks like the archaeology is coming back and saying that it was a little bit before Hezekiah's time. Fine. But what about some of these evidences of cultic installations or evidence of cultic worship here? And I definitely do think the standing stone there... It's definitely evidence of some type of religious nature of the site, and that it's early. But it was covered in this iron 2B or 8th century material. And so the platform itself would have been exposed. The standing stone would have been exposed in the 9th century or earlier. And then the fill goes on top of it, and then it's left there. Now, it looks like it was purposely put out of use, this entire area. And part of the reason why we can see that is because in room 5 at the back of it, there was a chamber where a rock wall was built up Inside the chamber, you have some material that is involved or used in some of the material that is in the floor outside. And so it looks like it was filled to the top at the same time, and this rock wall was built up at the same time as the whole area was canceled out of use. So why build this rock wall if you're going to cancel it out of use? This is the room that they're calling the Favisa, the place where discarded ritualistic or items that were used in worship at this site were placed. Now, there aren't the usual cultic objects inside this, and that's to be understood as well, because, you know, what is a cultic object related to worship in ancient Israel or ancient Judah? Let's say righteous worship. You're not going to have the typical religious paraphernalia that you would have at pagan or heathen sites. There'll be far less. What you do find in there is broken bits of pottery with writing on them, perhaps a partial basin And then you have some interesting seals and seal impressions. And I'm going to talk about that because this, I think that this gives us added insight into the dating of the site. And this is something that is largely overlooked, almost, I think, in Mayer's paper. It talks about these objects that they found inside the Favisa. So the Favisa was probably, even if the whole site was being cleaned from whenever it was built to the time period that the use of it was canceled, the Favisa, if it is a Favisa, there would be objects in there that date to the time period of the functioning of the rooms themselves. And what are the dates of some of the items inside here? Dozens of seal fragments were found in this location. Here we present examples of two sealings and two scarabs. So what's interesting is that none of these sealings or scarabs have writing on them. Writing on a seal or a seal impression, a bulla, this doesn't take place until the 8th century. Pretty much. I'd say the earliest is probably the 8th century. I think in mass, definitely. And yet we have examples of different pictographs or different drawings, motifs on these seals and these scarabs. What did they date to? It says the seals and scarab are similar to those found in iron 2A contexts, known mostly from the rock cut pool in Jerusalem. Rock cut pool is just the pool, it's just below them, attesting to the date of the last use of the structure. Furthermore, the presence of a motif documented in northern Syrian group also observed in the Ophel, with Dr. Mazar's excavations, what we were on, and Bet Shemesh may suggest regional connection to Jerusalem and the north, between Jerusalem and the north. So I think this is interesting. Iron 2A, there's debates over when the Iron 2A ended, but Iron 2A transitioned from Iron 1 to Iron 2A, we're going David, Solomon, thereafter. In Jerusalem, I would be of the opinion the Iron 2A ends a bit earlier than elsewhere in the land, but sometime very early 9th century. Is the last use of the whole thing. We'll just read it. He's saying that the last use of these happened in the Iron 2A, and then you have the dumps going on in the Iron 2B. So you've got a period, intervening period, where the place is not being used. And then finally it is put out of use sometime in the Iron 2B, mid-8th century BC. Now, this is interesting because that would imply it's a site, a sacred site, that is not being used for a good 100 years or so, perhaps even more. And why would that happen? Now let's go to what the Bible says of an area somewhere in this vicinity. And this, I hope, is where we can put it together. We can. That's the archaeology, rock cut tombs, probably a cultic value to them. The best part, I think, about, or one of the good parts about Aaron Mayer's paper is that he talks about these V-cuts, and he leads us to believe, or he puts evidence that these V-cuts could be used for wood bending, for chariot wheels or something else. Very interesting idea. I wouldn't want to blow it out of the park and say it's not true. I'll leave a link to it. I just watched a Nova documentary. It's part of it's online where they actually are recreating chariot wheels. and I think it was from about 10 or 15 years ago, and they did this. They bent the wood into a V shape so that they could then create the spokes for the chariot wheel. And he says what we could have here, and he bases it on an example that McAllister excavated it at Tel Asaf Yogath, his site, 100 years ago or so. And he went and he tracked down these bedrock V-shaped cuts there. And indeed, they do look very similar. So does that have a cultic function as well over in Gath? But I do think that's a worthwhile an option for these V-cuts rather than just being for a stand to slaughter a beast. Nevertheless, let's go to the Bible. I think it is worth it. Nothing in this study, I think, discredits the opportunity for the area to be in use during King David's time at all. I would say it looks like it's a little bit before Melchizedek, a little bit after Melchizedek's time. The reason it's interesting is because David was the one that writes about Melchizedek. I think it's Psalm 110. He's got this concept of Melchizedek in his mind when he takes Jerusalem. Why is Jerusalem so important to David? Well, it has a history of Abraham paying tithes to Melchizedek. At the time that David takes the city, the Ark of the Covenant, the footstool of God, it was not there in Israelites. Well, it was not in the tabernacle. It was in Israelite territory, but not in the tabernacle. And David decides after he builds his palace and shortly thereafter, and this is mentioned in 1 Chronicles 15, that he wants to go fetch the ark and bring it where? Bring it to Jerusalem. Now you can see from other scriptures that the tabernacle was functioning, it's at Gibeon. And so why not take the Ark of the Covenant to Gibeon? David decides not to. David decides that he's going to bring the ark into a special place that he has built, that he has prepared for it. It says this, verse 1, this is the JPS, and they brought in the ark of God and set it in the midst of the tent that David had pitched for it, and they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before God. And when David had made an end of the offering, the burnt offerings and the peace offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Eternal. So this is before Solomon's born. This is before the episode with Bathsheba. So it happens pretty early on, and you notice it's in the city of David, this Ark of the Covenant, in a place what David has prepared. It's a place they can do burnt offerings. It's somewhere close that they can do burnt offerings here. Verse 37, so he left there before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, Asaph and his brethren, to minister before the Ark continually as every day's work required. So Asaph is going to stay there. Famous musician from David's time, and Obed-Edom with their brethren, 80. Obed-Edom also, the son of Jeduthun and Hosa, to be the doorkeepers. And Zadok, or Tzadok, the priest, and his brethren, the priests, before the tabernacle of the Lord in the high places that was at Gibeon. So around this time, this is probably around 1,000, maybe slightly thereafter, 1,000 BC. And Solomon's temple, it's not going to be finished constructed till around 960. So we've got this period of about 40 years. Ark of the Covenant is there with Asaph. There is different offerings. There is a ritualistic service that is going on there, or a religious service that is going on there. And then there's also the tabernacle at Gibeon, just north of Jerusalem. Then you've got chapter 17 and verse 1. It says, it comes to pass, David dwelt in his house, and David said to Nathan the prophet, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord dwells under curtains. That's still in the city of David. That's where it's dwelling under curtains at this time. And then jump forward to chapter 21. In between, you have the sin with Bathsheba. But then going forward, you have this David taking the census, this angel of the Lord coming and stopping in the north of the city of David on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. So this is another place in Jerusalem, not where the ark was located. If this is verse 22. And David said to Ornan, give me the place of this threshing floor that I may build thereon an altar unto the Eternal, and so on. So David is going to build an altar there. And it says verse 28, and at that time when David saw the Lord had answered him in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, that he sacrificed there for the tabernacle of the Lord, which Moses has made in the wilderness, and the altar of burnt offering were at that time in the high place of Gibeon. So here you are towards the end of David's reign. Now you have another place of religious worship. You have Gibeon, tabernacle. You have what's going on with Asaph, City of David. And then you have Ornan's threshing floor up the hill, and David building an altar there, an altar of sacrifice. And that is going to be the location of where the altar of sacrifice will go for the temple that Solomon is going to build. Okay, jump forward a little bit more. This is right at the death of David, and Adonijah's claiming to be king, another son of David. And Bathsheba comes to David and says, I thought Solomon was going to be king. He's like, dead right, go grab my mule. And this is what you should do. And this is verse 32 of 1 Kings 1. And David, King David said, call me Zadok the priest, and Nathan the prophet, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada. And they came before the king, and the king said unto them, take with you the servants of your lord, and cause Solomon my son to ride upon mine own mule, and bring him down to Gihon. And let Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet anoint him there, at Gihon, king over Israel. And blow you the horn and say, long live King Solomon. So this is where the location in that it's going to happen. But notice this, if we go to verse 38. So Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and the Kerethites and the Pelethites, they went down and they caused Solomon to ride upon the King David's mule, and they brought him to Gihon. And Zadok the priest took the horn of oil out of the tent and anointed Solomon. And they blew the ram's horn. All the people said, long live King Solomon. So did he run to the tabernacle at Gibeon and grab the horn of oil from there? No, he went into the tent that David had prepared for the Ark of the Covenant by the Gihon and grabbed the oil. And right there by the Gihon, that's the dating for this site. Yes, it ends in the 8th century, but it could have been sometime before, and most likely was sometime before the 8th century that this was in use. There's an olive press right there as well. And so was this area covered with a tent? And did he go into this area by the Gihon with Solomon, grab the oil from out of there and anoint Solomon with the oil from this area? I think it's pretty obvious if you're going to take the text. What's kind of amazing to me is that the Bible stated this 3,000 years ago, that by the Gihon spring, this is where Solomon was anointed. And we know that the ark was in the city of David. It doesn't tell us exactly where the ark was. And yet here, it does kind of tell us, because he's going into the tent by the Gihon and the tent where David set up to grab the oil. So we can conclude that 3,000 years ago, they're writing about how in the area of the Gihon spring, there is a tent with a horn of oil in it, So there's an olive press nearby as well. And then, you know, they just happen to be digging right by the Gihon spring, and they find an olive press, they find a matzevah, they find what they believe to be a fazivisa, and it's canceled in the 8th century. There is Middle Bronze Age remains all around this area, very close to it. It's built into bedrock, so we don't really have a good start date for it. What are the chances? What are the chances that you find a place with ritualistic function, cultic function by the Gihon Spring, that if you put the archaeological evidence together, sure, it's not conclusive of the dating, but it matches so well with the biblical text. So just after this, you've got King Solomon. Now, once he's made king, David dies, starts to build the temple, starts it in his fourth year. Takes 7 years to build, so we're probably around 960, and that's when Solomon does this. This is 1 Kings chapter 8 and verse 1. It says, then Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the princes of the fathers' houses of the children of Israel, unto King Solomon in Jerusalem to bring up the ark of the covenant out of the Lord, out of the city of David, which is Zion. So he's going to bring it out of the city of David, the place where David had put it. And then finally it says, and it came, this is verse 10, and it came to pass when the priests were come out of the holy place that the cloud filled the house of the Lord, so that the priests could not stand a minister by reason of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Eternal. So I think, and this is somewhere in the Iron 2A. This is sometime in Iron 2A, Jerusalem. We have the temple functioning. the temple's going to start working. And you don't have Tabernacle, of course, in Gibeon, Ark in City of David. You have the Tabernacle or the Altar of Sacrifice there, further north in the city where the temple was, and you have the Ark there as well. So what happens to this location? Well, according to Shukron in the Iron 2A, is when this whole thing fell out of use, and it probably just stayed vacant. What do you do? Maybe it was walled up at the time, or just stayed vacant, unused. It's a previous holy site, and so it just stays open for a certain amount of time. Now, you do find this. You do find this at certain sites. You find an area that it might have habitation or construction in it at the base of it, on the floor layer or something, and then you have a break for about 200 years or 100 years, and then the fill that fills it up with the floor, the new construction in the area is dated for 200 years after. So what happened? Well, this area was hallowed. This area was respected. This area, you left it. I think it matches very well what they found with the dating here inside the Favisa, with these ceilings that date sometime in the Iron 2A period, that this whole site is going to come out of use. Why is it going out of use? Because the temple is constructed. Now, all this is a historical reconstruction, which the archaeological evidence, I believe, does actually fit well with. However, the archaeology, because the dating is so wide and so broad and difficult because it's carved into bedrock, archaeology probably isn't going to give us a better answer than what we already have. I mean, the place is excavated. Not too much more information they can get. I mean, the big thing to do would be go over to the Matseva and rip out the stone and dig away the platform and find the dating for that. But I don't necessarily advise that. But that would be a way to get down to the archaeological dating of this, is to actually excavate the ritual cultic item that is still there at the time, this standing stone, and see what date you get. However, when I tour this area, I think based on the archaeological evidence that is before us, I can say with confidence that we do have an area with some small scale ritual function. This isn't the temple. This isn't the tabernacle where you had the daily sacrifices going on in terms of the burnt sacrifice with the altar of sacrifice out the front. That's some industrial level religious function going on at Gibeon and then going on later on in the temple. But while it's going on in Gibeon, you have the Ark of the Covenant here. There was religious worship here, but it was small scale. So I'm not expecting to find massive evidence of animal bones. And so I think this site, while I can't say for sure it's Melchizedek's time, I still think it fits so well with the area that King David placed the Ark for decades before King Solomon's led by God to build the temple further up on the hill and then finally retrieve the Ark. And then this location just laid dormant, respected, until a later time, perhaps even 100, 200 years later, it was filled, and then new construction would go along over the top. Perhaps there was a later king. Perhaps it isn't Hezekiah, who's known as a religious king, a righteous king, and perhaps he wouldn't have been the one to do it. But perhaps it was an earlier king that understood this location, didn't like it, and buried it. I'm not sure. We'll have to, perhaps there'll be some added dating that does come out in time. But until then, we don't know. And until then, I think from the archaeological evidence we have, do we have Temple Zero? Perhaps not from Melchizedek's time. Don't know. Maybe. Is it from David's time? Does it function as David from David's time? I think when you put the Bible together with the archaeology, we have a pretty good match. That's all from the program. Thanks very much for joining me. If you like the program, don't forget to like and subscribe. You can also request our magazine I mentioned before, Let the Stone Speak, to sign yourself up for your free subscription. Please go to armstronginstitute.org and scroll down, or write an email to letters@armstronginstitute.org, put your name and address, and we'll sign you up. Thanks for being with me.